Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Tea on tap. It's good for the environment too, as it uses the vacuum to keep the water hot. Absolutely no idea how that works, but it means you don't have to constantly reheat the water. So it's great for the environment. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's Lovejoy Hour, it's a bit different, but I loved it, and I hope you enjoy it too. This hour, I'm curious about Raging Bull, the film, and I'm curious about Jay Glenny, who's written an amazing book about the film and now has Robert De Niro and Martin Scorsese on speed dial. I just think this is a great story, a man who's passionate about films and who's produced a lovely piece of art. Let's meet him and you can find out the whole story yourself. Here's Jay Glenny. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Tim. Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
I suppose this is a little unusual for me, a bit of a different direction, but I'm just always curious about things. So I suppose the first thing we need to do is find out a little bit about yourself first. So tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm from Essex, as you can probably tell by my vernacular. And I've always had a huge interest in films. Just quickly fast forward into the Raging Bull, but and a huge interest in Robert De Niro. So much so that I read that he wore silk underpants in New York, New York, and made my mum buy me some silk underpants. Wow. And when you go to an Essex comprehensive school, you need pretty broad shoulders to get changed for sports, and we've all you're wearing silk underpants. I've always had a huge love of film, and then many years ago I started writing TV formats, coming up with silly ideas, which I know you're prone to do on Sunday brunch, coming up with an idea for a format.
Yeah, did you get any made?
Yes, I got a few off the ground, which proved we sold a few to Celadon, people like that. And I came up with an idea late one night, and we'd only just had our first daughter, I believe. I know that because I woke my wife up to tell her what a great idea I'd had. As you know, Tim, when you've got young children, you don't wake mum up.
Exactly right, yeah.
And the idea was to interview British Oscar winners. And I'd had a JD, I remember. Other brands are available. I'd had a JD. It was quite late and it felt like the best idea in the world. And in the morning, it still felt pretty good. So I started to write a list of British Oscar winners. And fast forward, I interviewed all manner of people and no one asked what I was doing with these interviews. No one asked whether it was going to be a TV show, a book, anything. No agent. And before I knew it, I was sitting down. Michael Caine was teaching me how to make a great roast potato. So Ben Kingsley, Jeremy Irons was opening up his play. He was in a play. So he opened up his door and there was Jeremy Irons. And I was interviewing all and sundry. And nobody asked what the project was for.
Were you meeting these people face to face?
So agents out there always ask. Yeah. And then, to my surprise, my ignorance, I didn't realise that the three producers of The Deer Hunter were British. And so they immediately went into my pile of wishes. And when I interviewed them, Tim, I initially assumed that their stories would be full of triumph. And it was, obviously, they'd won the best picture, the crown and glory for any film producer. And but equally, their stories are so full of rancor and bitterness and falling out that immediately my antennae went up and I thought, oh, there's a bigger story here. So I started writing away to some of the crew and some of the cast to see if they'd tell me their stories. And they started coming back and saying yes, and some studio people. And the story started to grow. And I knew then that I was going to have to ask my idol Robert De Niro if he'd come on board, and I did, I sent it over to Stan, his PR guy, and Stan came back to me. And if I recall rightly as well, it was within a few hours. And I opened the email, huge trepidation with one eye. And it was, I think Bob would be up for this. Really? I mean, you can't hear some books behind me, but this whole wall is full of film books. There's film books here, much to Kelly, my wife's joy. So we've only got a few hundred in the house because my office is in the garden. But there's loads of sort of books around Bob and films he's been in. But invariably, he's never been interviewed. And being a fan, I'd never find an interview of any consequence with him. So he's always Travis Bickle. He's always Jimmy Doyle. He was always Vito Corleone. The characters were him. So I was surprised that he said yes, for starters. But he did. And we spoke and we got on so well. And it was so easy. And the project just then developed. Meryl Streep came on board. Chris Walken came on board. So then I had to sell the book company. There's no way I could wing this one. And that's when Coattails came about. I'd co-written a book on The Man That Fell to Earth. And I was interviewed by Mr. Ross, Mr. Jonathan Ross.
Yeah.
For his radio show. And when he came out to me and the co-writer, came out, and there was a few other people waiting to be interviewed as well. One of them, I think, was Bobby Gillespie. He said, hello, you riding on the coattails of David Bowie. I'll speak to you later. that's a good name for a publishing company, because all my stories will be on the coattails of somebody.
Brilliant.
So we set up Coattails, and in the interim, the Deer Hunter story was growing. The famed producer, Sandy Lieberson, who'd contributed to the Man That Fell to Earth book, and I gave him a copy to say thank you. He said, would you replicate that with a book on performance? So I said, yes. No, if you've got the images, because I want the books to be really lush, full of story, but also full of images. And he said, look, come down. So I went down. There's this huge treasure trove of just artifacts from the film. So then my next caveat was, I'd do it if Nick comes back on board, Nick Rogue. He said yes. And then my next caveat was, if I can get Mick Jagger. And he said yes. James Fox said yes. So then I had two books to publish for my fledgling little company. And then fast forward to Christmas, year before last, Bob and I met up again. He was over. I think he was promoting The Irishman. So we met up in his hotel when he'd finished all his press duties, and I presented him with the Deer Hunter book, and which is always weird when Bob De Niro asks you to inscribe a book to him. would you write to him? Keep up the good work. he was just, he loved it. And then he asked me what was next, and being a good Essex lad, I wasn't going to turn that opportunity down. So I immediately said, look, it was the 40th anniversary last year of Raging Bull, but as we know, the pandemic put stop to a lot of things, and one of them was the celebrations around the film. So I knew I had a bit more time. So I said Raging Bull. He said yes. And then after Christmas, I was researching and just gently prodding around the film. And then the pandemic hit in March. Cinemas were closing. My work was a bit drying up. I work sort of across social media for people as well, like Tyres as the media insurers, and showcase cinemas, but the films were drying up a little bit. So I quickly messaged Bob and said, look, I'm going to start. He gave me the green light. So we spent hours on the phone, started interviewing the cast and crew. Martin Scorsese came on board. He and Bob opened up their archives. And then the book was written. I thought I'd finished it. And I had an email from Bob on a Monday morning. Jay, I need to ring you ASAP. Are you free now? And no matter how close you are, and you know the relationship we've built up, this trust, there's still an email from Robert De Niro asking you for an ASA phone call. So your bum does go a little bit, and he wasn't that at all. He said, I spoke to Joe last night, because I think I'd had three or four no's from his team. He doesn't give interviews. He said, I spoke to Joe last night, and he's up for it. So if you ring him, and I did, and it was a dream to talk to Joe Pesci. He's the first couple of questions were a little bit, you know,
yeah,
a little bit yes, no-y. But after that, he opened up and we got on like a house on fire.
All right, this book, Jay, is absolutely fantastic. But you've said a couple of things there I must go back to. First of all, our listeners will be desperate to know, what programs did you sell? What sort of programs were you selling in your early career?
One of the ones I sold was a show called No Waste Like Home. And I think I sold it too early. I sold it to Celador. And it was a presenter would go into the house and green up the house.
Right.
But I think probably I was probably a decade too early. I'd probably get that away again now.
That's what I say about all my ideas. They're always too early. Yeah. yeah. This book is so amazing. I think what we've got to work.
It means a lot.
Honestly, it's just such a beautiful piece of art. And you know, it's so hard to put it down when you start reading it. If I can describe this to the listeners, it's just this huge book with these beautiful pictures, and then all these wonder. It's done in such a great way that you can't put it down. You just want to keep reading it. All the characters involved in it, and you just learn. I ended up watching the film again last night because I ended up reading the book and thinking I need to watch this film again. I've not watched it for, I don't know, 20 odd years, more than that probably. So, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But is this a career? I mean, you've got all these beautiful books. Do they actually generate money for you, or is it just a passion?
Well, my wife is still waiting for the bathroom to be redecorated. that's probably the truthful answer. I've been putting that off. So this is my golf. I've never picked up a golf stick apart from a bit of crazy golf, but I've never played golf. So this is my golf. I'd like to make it a proper business. We've got a nice little, me and my best buddy, Steve Wilkin, we've got a nice little cottage industry. The Deer Hunter was meant to launch last year at the Tribeca Film Festival. That was obviously null and void. So we're a little bit behind on the Deer Hunter launching that. But the Raging Bull literally launched this week. And we started sending out the pre-orders because these guys have been supporting us for so long. They've been kindly bought the book back in January. So we've got the pre-orders out this week and the response has been phenomenal.
Right.
And yeah, it really has. I gave the exclusive sort of US rights first excerpt to Hollywood Reporter, and that dropped last night, I believe, and consequently, yeah, I haven't had much sleep. My phone was pinging with orders coming in.
That's great. I suppose everybody wins in this book. You win because you've just created this absolute masterpiece. And De Niro and everyone involved in the book wins because they've got this little piece of history done so beautifully. And I mean, you know, it was that De Niro won an Oscar for this film. So I'm sure he loves this as a memento to flick through and read. You know, it's such a great souvenir for him. And the readers win because it is a beautiful thing to own. I think a good idea at this point would be for anyone who's not seen Raging Bull to explain what the film is about.
Yeah, it's a tough one because immediately you think it's a biopic about Jake LaMotta, the famed or infamous for some people middleweight boxer. So you immediately think it's a boxing sports biopic, and quote me on the exact, but I expect 10 minutes of boxing's in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about, don't get me wrong as well, I learned more about this film as the last year I've been on the journey, and I thought I knew a lot about it. But as Marty said, that it was a film to him about redemption. And I think ultimately that's what it is, really. It's a character study. And when you look at the polls, the film polls, Raging Bull is always or invariably towards the top of the greatest films released in the 80s. And to me, Tim, it isn't. To me, it's a 70s film. It's an auteur 70s film. And auteur generally means, you know, there's a single person at the helm. And this one, there wasn't to me. It literally was Bob and Marty. So that those two guys took this from, I think it was 74 Bob wanted to make it. And it took them, you know, that 6 years to get it off the ground and find a screenplay, which, as you know, they rewrote themselves. And I think, yeah, one of the greatest character studies ever. certainly one of
the best. Yeah, because Jake LaMotta wasn't the nicest of characters, no. Was he? He was a boxer who turned into a stand-up comic, and he was very violent. Did he have seven wives or something? And he was a kid who'd grown up on the streets and learned how to. I mean, I've learned all this from your book, basically. But, kid who grew up on the streets and learned how to fight. He had a very hard head, and he took a lot of punishment in the ring. He had a lot of big fights, and people, according to in the film, people were scared to fight him in the end.
Yeah, which is true. I mean, he was called the Bronx Bull, and he always went on the attack. He had very, very delicate hands, so he wanted to get an opponent out quickly. I mean, it was such not a boxing film that one of the other things I discovered was that Marty didn't want to include any boxing in it. That was his initial plan. It was going to be a complete character study, and right. Which is, just sounds ludicrous now, because it reinvented how boxing was portrayed in film. I mean, the camera was in the ring with you, and it's so brutal.
Again, I learned this from the book. The camera was always in the ring with them, which meant that you were part of the fight, and that comes across. And it's been done so many times now, but I'm sure at the time, if you could tell us what the climate of the cinema world was like, or film world at the time. I mean, I don't think that had been done before, had it?
No. And also, what's really clever as well, that Marty came up with the idea to stretch the ring, so effectively you had four rings, so the camera could zoom right across, which was gives it that breadth and that depth to the boxing matches. And also, they were I think probably the right word as well, they were privileged to work with a sound engineer called Frank Warner, and he revolutionized sound. And I'm sure you can remember last night, Tim, when the punches are coming in, you had braying horses and things like that. Them animal noises really get into your head when they're in the ring. And once again, I mean, these have been pillared now, and raped and pillared in so many films, but at the time it was my camera's just moving. And at the time, it was really revolutionary. No one had ever done that before.
Yeah, well, one of the big things I noticed was the sound, because whenever there was any form of conversation in an apartment, the windows were open. I think they were generally sort of filming like it was kind of a summer vibe or something going on, or by the swimming pool. And the noises were just like these great street noises constantly. And you thought, wow, it really took me back to cinema and how noises used to feel. And in places it was slightly messy, I thought, which I loved, because it's like old vinyl, how there's a bit of a scratch on it or something. Yeah. Sometimes, everything's so clean now because it's so accurate. And there was like a few force. The other thing that I thought was really fascinating about it, and obviously everyone's talked about this, but they've talked about it so much you don't think about it, it's in black and white. And yet halfway through the film, when they show the cine footage, the wedding and all that sort of stuff, honeymoons and all that, it's all in color. It's such a surreal, bizarre experience. And watching it with a critical eye after reading so much of the book, I was like, wow, this is such a fascinating piece of art.
Yeah, and it really does shift you, doesn't it, as a viewer, when it's all of a sudden you now are in color. And Owen Winkler, the producer, sorry to keep saying told me, but
it's good.
Yeah, I was on a journey of discovery as well, and he told me the opposition they had, for filming in black and white, and also the language, the subject matter, the animal Jake LaMotta. And he's of the firm belief that it could have only been made at United Artists during that time. They had such a run of Best Picture Oscar winners, but also they had the strength of the Bond films. But they also, what Irwin had in his back pocket was Rocky.
Right.
And Rocky II was not going to go to United Artists unless they gave the green light to Raging Bull. And when Rocky, obviously the first Rocky, broke every box office record and won the Best Picture Oscar, and there's no way United Artists were going to let that go. So what was effectively a relatively small budget film, Raging Bull, Bob, Marty, all of them worked for Scowl. And I think that's what happened. They got under the radar and they were allowed to produce a black and white film. Tim, it never went to preview. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, the Deer Hunter book there, a couple of years previously, that was previewed beyond belief. Performance never even got released for 2 years because the studio hated it so much. Raging Bull never even went to preview. It was released before anybody'd seen it, any critic, anybody.
And how did it do? Because it didn't do that well, did it, to begin with?
No, it didn't. Financially, it didn't. I think what I alluded to earlier didn't help. I think it would have been released in the 70s. I'm sure it would have been a more of a box office hit. But because it was released in the 80s, you then had, it was in the birth of the whole Reagan era, and big box office films were suddenly the norm, and this wasn't. It wasn't.
Is that era the sort of Jaws era
and Star Wars
sequels, and stuff? Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was watching it thinking this was a time just before then, and films seem to have a lot more. They seem to be a lot more arty. Film was different then, I think, and obviously things move on. We had videos suddenly arriving, and so the demand now, I mean, look at the drama now. There's so much drama that film and box sets have blurred, you know. Which would you rather do as an actor? In the good old days, listen to me, that you used to be a film actor or a TV actor, they didn't cross over, and nowadays they'll do anything, because both forms are so, have got such good quality to them.
That's so true, Tim. And purely, and what is what, an hour and a half, 2 hour film? You now get 12 hours to investigate a character.
Yeah.
But the quality hasn't dropped. Look at the series that you and I are thinking of as we talk about TV series. The quality is just tremendous. I think that's why that crossover is happening.
When you watch the film back, though, like I did last night, what was so interesting about it? It became in places a bit of a tough watch, because it's been plagiarized so much, that film, that in some places you're thinking, oh my God, this is so cliche, only because everybody else has copied it, and you have to keep going back and going, no, this was the original. This is why everybody else has copied that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the slow-mo at the beginning in particular, I mean, that theme and the slow-mo, it's just, I mean, that's been done so many times, isn't it, in the boxing ring? Just a little story as well. It isn't in the book, but on my first Zoom chat with Marty, I never was fortunate enough to go to any form of film school, but it's like attending a film school. It really is. It's unbelievable, Tim. Seriously, if you ever get the chance to spend any time with him, your brain's doing somersaults. His energy is just infectious. And he was talking about the theme. Jay, wait there. And then he's gone from the screen. He'd come back and said, I found this album earlier today, and I thought Jay would want to see this. And he's got the album, and it was given to him as a 4-year-old. But when he spun it round, he'd put a dot alongside what was going to be the theme tune to Raging Bull 20, 30 years later. That's how much he loved it as a 4-year-old.
Wow.
And he said, I've been wanting to place it in a film since then. And then it went, wow, I know where this can come. This is the beginning of the film. This is my theme.
Yeah. Yeah. And that music now is so iconic, because you know, what's he like? What makes him so special, Scorsese?
I think because his knowledge is just encyclopedia. I mean, I can talk to films, as it's probably coming across on this podcast. And you can, you're a big film fan. Many people I have, but you're not even in the same sphere as Marty. So that's his energy and his love of film. And I think, I think it's in the book, isn't it? Is it, Tim? I don't know if you read that part, but one of the other reasons about the film being in black and white was because the stock was eroding. And his preservation of film is legendary. It's legendary. I mean, the films he saved, the wonderful Powell and Pressburger films, Marty saved those almost single-handedly, Red Shoes and films like that.
Right.
Death of Colonel Blimp. And in fact, he introduced Michael Powell to Thelma Schumacher, his editor, and they consequently married. And I think that just comes across. And at the end of the book, when I thought it'd be a good idea to bring some filmmakers in, purely so I could get to talk to them, to talk about the legacy of Raging Bull. It was literally, I mean, I could have spent the next year doing the legacy section, because there isn't a filmmaker alive that doesn't revere Raging Bull.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you've got Francis Ford Coppola saying yes, Brian De Palma, Michael Mann, Richard Linklater, Asif, and Stephen Graham, you're thinking, oh my word. And then these guys are I'd pay to talk to them many years ago.
Yeah. Didn't De Niro force Scorsese into doing it? I mean, he was the driving force behind the film, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah, he was. He, as I said, he wanted he was given the book in 74, and Marty wasn't interested. They'd done Mean Streets and struck up a really great friendship. Marty had been given a screenplay called Taxi Driver, so that's where he wanted to set on. And so you think Jake LaMotta and Travis Bickle are not too far apart from as disturbed characters. So he didn't really want to dive in straight into Jake LaMotta's head. So then they'd done New York, New York. And I absolutely, as I alluded to with the silk pants, I loved New York, New York, but it wasn't well received. And by his own admission, Marty went on a bit of a spiral, drugs and rock and roll. And it wasn't until he woke up in a hotel, sorry, and in a hospital bed with Robert De Niro looking over him that he come to his senses. He was, effectively he was dying. He had to recuperate. And Bob said, "Look, there's only you can make this film." So they went away to St. Martin and rewrote Paul Schrader's screenplay and made it their own. And that's the other thing with these adventures of writing these books. You'll be chatting to somebody and there's they mention about a picture they've got. And Gloria Norris, who's a young girl who'd worked with Brian De Palma, I tracked her down because I knew that she'd gone to St. Martin to transcribe their screenplay. And she, on the last day, Bob said, "We haven't got any pictures." So she had a camera and took some pictures, and no one's ever seen them. And they're in the book. Do you in the coloured pictures? There's
Right,
pictures of
okay,
them on the beach
right.
holding up with hats on, paper hats. They're in the coloured section at the back. And I mean, when I said, Gloria, you haven't got an iPhone handy, have you?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "You wouldn't take a couple of pictures and quickly text them over?" And when she did, Tim, it was just a case I had to have them. They're just extraordinary, just historical facts, really. No one's ever seen them, and these kind of things have to go in a book of this breadth. Have you found them yet?
No, I'm
In
just
the
flicking.
back where the
Oh yeah,
colored
I've got
pictures
them.
are.
I'm
Yeah, I
looking
mean,
through
how good are
them.
they, Tim?
Oh, they're fantastic. Yeah,
Aren't
they're
they?
really good.
Look at them. I mean, I've
And the
never
Hawaiian
ever.
shirts.
Yeah, I've never seen Bob like that before, ever portrayed like that. And that's the as you get to know him, that's the funny guy that he is.
Yeah, what is he like, De Niro? Because listen to me. You call him Bob. Some people call him Robert. I'm calling him De Niro. But what's he like? Because he comes across as quite a serious guy. Because we haven't pointed out yet that he puts on some ridiculous amount of weight, 60 pounds, which is like 4 stone to play the end of the film. I mean, he was a proper method actor, wasn't he?
He was, although
Or he
he
still
never,
is.
yeah, he never calls it the method. He just calls it preparation. What just before we get onto that, what Marty done so well was that the press had got hold of the weight gain, and when they first showed Irwin the film, it was almost in chronological order. So what they done really well is they put Bob or Jake LaMotta in his later years at the front of the picture. So
Yeah.
then the viewer wasn't waiting. He wasn't waiting for an hour and a half. Where is he? Where's Bob Fat? Where's De Niro Fat? You already
Right.
saw that. So now we can get into the movie.
Oh, what a good, but that's great. That is a brilliant story. Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And
because
I think
that's
it would,
true.
yeah, I think it would do. You'd be waiting, wouldn't you? I
Yeah,
mean,
you would. Yeah, because it's such a big story. Yeah.
yeah. And the press were probably a little bit more innocent in those days. Now, trying to capture a picture of Bob with 60 pounds, but it's also 60 pounds, Tim, after making himself into a middleweight boxer.
Yeah.
I mean, how his physique was just, you and I would die for it. It's just amazing, isn't
Yeah,
it?
and Jake LaMotta said that he was a pretty decent with the way he boxed, wasn't he,
Yeah,
De
he was.
Niro?
Bob refuted that. He said, no, Jay, that's Jake, that's Jake. You know, Jake could overcook things, you know, no. Yeah, and so yeah, I think that it was perhaps a little bit of Jake LaMotta, but I mean, he certainly was fit. But when I first emailed, so the listeners know that I'm not being a pretentious tool. When I first emailed Rob De Niro's team, and when it was a yes, and then I got to know his assistants, and we're setting up a time, they said, "You have to call him Bob because his dad is Robert De Niro. His dad
Right.
was an acclaimed artist." So you've got Robert De Niro, and Robert De Niro that you and I know through films is actually Robert De Niro Jr.
Right. Okay.
So that's why he's called Bob. So because you know, I can imagine how much ribbon I've got for mates.
I wouldn't care if I could pick up the phone and talk to Robert De Niro. I wouldn't get, you can rib me as much as you want. I don't give a damn. I'm on first names with Bob. so I don't care.
so that's where that comes from. But he's always been so, so loyal, so trustworthy, knowing that I won't break the trust, and so given anything I wanted to run by him, he has, via email, phone call, Zoom. I mean, Tim, geez, I'm at the beginning of this little journey. I mean, you've been around many people in your career. You still know that they're still Robert De Niro. As much as I call him Bob, he's still Robert De Niro. I mean, that first time he was over at Christmas, and I wanted to show him the performance book because it was, it showed, you know, just why I wanted to take the Deer Hunter. So we met in his hotel at breakfast, and for Christmas, he was over for Christmas. And when he opened his hotel door, it's like Robert De Niro standing there. And I don't care how cool you are, if you're in my game of loving films for as long as I have, it's still bloody Robert De Niro opening the door.
Yeah, he's a proper star, proper Hollywood star.
But yeah. he never once has ever. And I can say this as well, because I'm very dear friends with a lady that's been in his life for many years, and who Bob put me in touch with to facilitate his archives and such like, and any just to open some doors. And he's never once made me feel as though I'm not worthy of being talking to him. It's extraordinary, seriously. And anybody you speak to that has met that Robert De Niro says the same. John Turturro told me, everybody has told me that's the Bob that I've got to know, that they've known for all these years. Bob on a chat show with makeup on, lights and a microphone, doing the press junkets that I've been to, and you've got 5 minutes and you ask the beginning, middle and end question that he's been asked all day long, because you know you've got to go away and write something about it. That's not the Bob that I've got to know. Been really, 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 just the best guy.
We're pleased to say today's podcast is sponsored by Baroni, fresh frozen pasta now in the freezer aisles in Waitrose. Yes, I did say that, frozen pasta. It's the same pasta that's used in restaurants around the country. What they do is they cook it al dente and then they immediately freeze it, so it has no additives or preservatives in it. All you have to do is drop it in a pan of boiling water and give it a stir. It's ready to serve in only 30 seconds. This stuff is truly delicious. Thank you for sponsoring the podcast. Those junkets are weird for them, aren't they? Because I've been on a few of those, and that's such a strange thing to do. You get told, by the way, as a presenter, you get told you've got 5 minutes and you've got to come out with a piece. So you have to ask the same questions that everyone else asks, really, because it's tough. The only time I got a bit of wriggle room was when I was with Al Gore. I had to interview him once, and I started questioning.
For the documentary, Tim.
Pardon?
For his documentary.
But I started questioning some of his things, and when the PR started winding it up, Al went, no, I want to answer these guys' questions because I think it's important. And I was like, yes, I did it. I got more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
7 minutes. Yeah. But but it's true. And I feel sorry for them because they just got to answer the same old crap. But everybody knows what it is. It's just the game. And that's how you promote a movie.
Was it the Richard Curtis film? With Richard Curtis film, is actually that part of the film portrayed it very well. I think it was the Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant film, and he come in as the journalist from the Horse and Hounds to one of the press junkets.
I can't remember that.
And he managed to meet Julia Roberts because he's just picked the magazine up.
Right.
So he's pretending that he's there, and he showed the press junket off to a tee, Richard Curtis did, because no doubt he's obviously been on the other side of it with you and I asking him questions and just how tedious it is.
I wonder with Marty and Bob on this movie, when they realized they had a piece of magic on their hands, obviously when they're filming it, but you talk about the press junket and everything. If it was a piece of film, a bit of art, which wasn't really what was happening at the time with all the huge movies happening in the 80s, when did they realize that it was going to be so critically acclaimed? Do you think they knew all the way from the beginning?
Speaking to them, I believe they knew they had something special, but they just had to wait for many people to catch up. And it wasn't until 2000, I believe, that Premier magazine, now defunct sadly, because it was one of the great movie magazines, the American movie magazine, labeled as the film of the decade. And then suddenly it started, it was released and then went out on a few select.
Jay, you just broke up there.
Did you say
film of the decade?
Yes, film of the decade. Yes, it was a Premier magazine labeled it the film of the decade, and it was then re-released. And they and then it started really getting critical acclaim. I think even the critics at the time were caught up in the whole Reagan sort of zeitgeist of that, you know, the Wall Street was thriving and everybody wanted to go to the cinema to have their popcorn and just see the next big blockbuster. And for the best will of the world, Raging Bull isn't that.
Do you know the other thing I thought last night watching it is Bob and Joe Pesci, when they're together on screen, I mean, the casting of those two, the acting quality from both of them is off the scale. They both arrived in such brilliant roles. I mean, they're both great actors, but when they're together in those scenes, it's just magical to watch, isn't it?
It is magical, but it's also so real, isn't it, Tim?
Yes.
You can't take your eyes off of it. I mean, that scene when he accuses him of sleeping with his wife.
Yeah.
You're watching it like this, aren't you? So tense. And to think it was Joe's, well, it's effectively his second movie, but you'll do well to find his first movie, you probably will, on re-release now, The Death Collector. And he packed up work and, packed up the film industry, didn't want to be anybody's lackey anymore, he told me, and went back to managing a pizzeria in Little Italy. And they, Sis Corman, the famed casting director, saw it as part of her job. She was famed at finding great faces. And she saw it, rung up Bob and said, I think we might have found Joey LaMotta. He then watched it and then rung up Marty, you've got to watch this film. This is Joey LaMotta. And then it was Sis's job to track him down. And she found him in an Italian restaurant.
Brilliant.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? And I think if I was perhaps, well, look at me, I got turned down to interview him four times. It took Bob to validate the project. But it was also, as it happened, it was a project that he holds so dear because it gave me, I think there's a quote at the beginning of the book from Joe, Raging Bull gave me my whole life.
Yeah, there's some good quotes all at the beginning of the book.
And I think that really holds true for Joe Pesci. Now, from then we get into the Lethal Weapons, the Home Alones, and obviously that's not even touching on Casinos and the Goodfellas.
Mm. Such a great actor.
It was, gave him a career. And then you had Kathy Moriarty, Tim.
Yeah,
she'd won a bathing competition in a bar, and Joe saw her picture behind a bar and said, that's Vicky LaMotta. Who is she?
Oh, wow. Oh,
she's a local girl. And she'd never even acted before, which is just remarkable.
Her quote at the beginning of the book is, I'll be forever grateful to Bob and Marty for the opportunity for the rest of my life.
Mm.
That's pretty good. What was Jake LaMotta like then working on the film? Because he was there, wasn't he, when they were doing it? He was helping do it. And what did he make of the final piece?
Well, he I think it shocked him. I wasn't fortunate enough to interview Vicky LaMotta, but in her autobiography, she said that Jake turned to her in the cinema in New York at the very small premiere they had and said, was I really that bad?
Oh, whoops.
And she said, Jake, you were worse. You know, and Bob told me that when they finished filming the fight scenes in Los Angeles, and then they went back to New York to do the domestic scenes, they said to Jake, no, Bob said, this is your time's up now. We've got to go back and make our own movie. We don't actually need you for this part of the movie. The boxing one, you were great as a confidant, but now we're going to go away and make our own film. So the first time he saw the film was in the cinema that night. And can you imagine, Tim, if that was your biography? You probably told all your chums, Robert De Niro's playing me in a new film, go and see it. And then, that's your life laid bare, isn't it?
Did he get a kickback? Did he get a few quid for it?
Yeah, I think he did. Well, it gave him another career on the talk show circuit, and he wasn't bumming around to doing soliloquies in nightclubs thereafter. I think he got married three more times.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think he died at 99, Tim.
Did he?
Okay. It's unbelievable, isn't it? I live a relatively healthy life. I won't live to 99. Jake LaMotta lived the worst life ever.
Well, I don't think we pointed out that he took a, well, we might have done it at the beginning, but he took an absolute punishment in the ring. One of the things was he could be punished, couldn't he? And the sort of implications are that he wanted to be, as you say, redemption for the life outside the ring, that he liked taking the punishment.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Because, and then you had somebody who's sort of renowned as being one of the gentlemen in the ring. Sugar Ray Robinson was his contemporary. And those bouts, I mean, I've only seen them on clips on YouTube, but they look they're just violent, aren't they? They look absolutely like animals in the ring. I don't know a lot about boxing. I won't allude that I pretend that I do, but Jake LaMotta's style is just barbaric, isn't it? Head down, shoulders hunched, and just swinging.
Yeah, and I suppose the other bit in it is the fact that the Mafia get involved and they're getting him to throw fights. And that's always sad because I'm sure that might be prevalent in boxing now. Who knows? I mean, you just don't know this stuff. It's such an easy thing to do. But, you know, that was a big thing that he was upset about. How close to the truth was that? Or was that?
That was absolutely spot on. The commission banned him. He got fined. And I think it was Irwin. It might have been Bob. One of them told me that was the biggest thing to hit him wasn't the fine. It was two things. A, he couldn't box, and B, he'd lost the respect from the local community. For him, that respect he had in his little enclave was everything to him. It sort of validated his reasoning of being Jake LaMotta.
Yeah, but in the film, it sort of says that he didn't really have a choice.
No, I don't think he did. I think if he wanted to fight, he wanted that crack at the title, he had to go through the Mafia. I mean, I'd love to talk to the actor, Nicholas, who played Coach in Cheers. The Mafia boss. So I'd love to have spoken to him because I think he played a really great. I don't know about you, but I only knew him through Cheers, really.
Yeah,
as a coach, I thought he played a really great Mafia boss, and as we know, that's sort of Marty's forte. That looking at the underbelly, the underworld.
Do you know I hadn't put those two together that they were the same. The same person. No.
Yeah, that's
wow. You've blown my mind a bit there. I'm sitting there going, what?
I think I hate talking about people when I don't really know the true facts, but I'm pretty sure he had a battle with alcohol.
Right.
So when he overcome his demons there, he lost a bit of weight because in Cheers he's a lot slimmer, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
So I think that's probably one of the reasons why we don't recognize him. But that's Coach from Cheers, Tim.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, I've asked you what Marty's like. What makes Robert De Niro so special then? What do you think? You know, you've met the man, you've seen him, and I'm sure he oozes charisma and talent, but what's the special ingredient?
Say this and work? I don't know if he does ooze charisma, and I don't think he'd mind me saying that. I think, and that's probably his talent, is that he completely loses himself in the characters.
Right.
There's a bit that Marty said in the book that when they were having dinner with Michael Powell, I don't know if you read that part yet, Tim, but Michael Powell, the famed director, came for dinner because in the film, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, oh my God, excuse my ignorance, the actor's name's gone out of my head, but the actor has to age, so he wore a fat suit. And Irwin, Marty, that weren't too happy that Bob was going to go down the route of putting on all this weight. It couldn't be healthy. So Marty said, just speak to him and how he done it. So Bob said, let's set up a meal. So they had a meal around his house. Harvey Keitel was there, Michael Powell, Thelma, I think Isabella Rossellini. They were having a nice meal together. And Michael turned to Marty and said, when's De Niro turning up? And Marty said, Michael, he's been sitting next to you the whole dinner. But because Bob doesn't say a lot and sort of sits back, Michael Powell didn't even realise it was Bob sitting next to him. And that, if I had to pick why he's such a great actor, that says it all.
His acting is in the
screen. You know, literally, the less he does, the more he does on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like? How did he put all the weight on then? How did he do it?
A lot of people, this once again, the sort of talking of journeys, I'd read, you know, that he went to ate his way around Italy and France, and that wasn't the case at all. What he did, he wanted to avoid the paparazzi in New York, so went to France on a 3-month holiday, and he actually said that he would rather, in retrospect, he should have gone to Italy, He said because France, he could only eat one big meal a day because it was so rich. Whereas in Italy, he could have ate more because it isn't as rich and he could have put the weight on quicker.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, he basically just ate and slept.
And how quickly did he do it? Did you find those?
It was 3 months. He had literally 3 months.
Oh, 3 months.
There's probably a little bit of a myth that's grown up, because what actually happened was they filmed all the boxing sequences first and then filmed some of the intermediate scenes in Florida and New York as Bob started eating.
Right. Okay.
Then they shut the film down. Marty went away and got married to Isabel Rossellini, and Bob went away on his eating trip, and then they come back and resumed the film. And Owen Winkler said that he was working on his next films, and this head came round the door, and he said, two things went through my head. Why the hell wasn't I told that somebody was coming into my office, and who the bloody hell is it? And it was Bob. He didn't recognise him. He put on so much weight, Tim.
And how long did it take him to lose?
Well, he said it took him a while. He still had it on for True Confessions, which was his next film with Owen Winkler, actually, as producer. It was his next film directly after Raging Bull. He plays a priest. So he said and it worked well because the priest was a little bit rounder and he had the smock on, so he could hide it. But he couldn't wait to get rid of it. And then he said when he picked up his son and put his son on his shoulders, he weighed more, the extra weight weighed more than his son did.
Right.
He said, I just knew. He said, and it was the last few pounds were the toughest to get rid of. Like they are when anybody you talk about a diet to, aren't they?
Yeah. And what does Marty and Bob, what do they think of the legacy of the film?
I think this is something they're hugely proud of. I think the easy answer is they spoke to me about it. I mean, if I'd gone to them with a film that, you know, which perhaps isn't in their canon of work, they wouldn't have spoken to me. I think that speaks volumes, but I think they know. There's a great quote, in fact, at the front of the book from Bob, you know, the pictures at the front of the book. Yep. And then the quotes that if you read that quote out, Tim, that says it all from Bob. I think it's about the third, fourth page in.
I knew that the work we put in and the way Marty directed Raging Bull, it would be special. No matter the success of the film financially, I just knew that we had something special. There was a lot of love and care put into it. I told Marty that I wasn't making a big deal of it. You didn't have to say a lot. We knew. Marty knew. De Niro. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, and I'm sure you've done interviews in your long career as well, Tim, that you, and when people, they just drop nuggets, don't they? And you think, oh my word. And there were so many nuggets dropped during these conversations, Tim. You just, oh my word. He didn't just say that, did he? He didn't just tell me that. And one of those was Marty, there's a section in there when you get to it. It's about when Bob and Marty meet at a party.
Yep.
Yeah, and that was one of the greatest sections I enjoyed writing and listening to. It was just, and I really am very, very proud of that section. And they met at a party that a famed sort of critic, Jay Cox, had given. Brian De Palma was there. Bob and Brian knew each other. So they were reintroduced at this party. And they both recognised each other as street kids. And it's wonderful piece. It really is a wonderful piece, not because of me, but because of what these guys were giving me. And Marty gave me something absolute beautiful bit that you'll read. And it says something along the lines of, there's not many of us left now who live that life. There's only Bob and I, and we're getting older. And that's something that connects us. And as he was saying it, I was getting emotional. He was getting emotional. And I just knew that if I could put that it down into words, that it would come across, and hopefully it has. And then Jay Cox, he said that my wife and I, we didn't bother packing up. It was Christmas Day the following day. We went to bed. He said, but I remember before I got into bed, I remember I looked across, and my friends had really connected. And I remember when he was telling me, I thought, no, this will end the book. And I've used it as the postscript at the end of the book. And then 50 with the benefit of 50 years, I now know that my friends were plotting the future of the American film industry.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and you think, look at the work that they've done together.
Yeah, I've got to say the bit at the beginning, I'll just read this. Martin Scorsese, why De Niro said that, I just read a minute ago. Scorsese says, I have said this before, but anybody thinking Raging Bull is a boxing picture would be out of their minds. It's brutal, yes, but it's a brutality that could take place not only in the boxing ring, but in the bedroom or in an office. Look, Jake is an elemental man, yeah. It's a great, but what's next for you then?
Well, I'm...
If De Niro can ask you what's next, I can. That's why.
Well, hopefully we're doing another book together, which I can't say live on air. But I'm 47,000 words into a book on Trainspotting with Danny Boyle.
Oh, brilliant.
So it'd be exactly the same format. I've got the cover. I'll send you the cover, Tim. It's stunning. I'm not just saying. Shouldn't judge a book by the covers, ABC once sung, but this cover is glorious. So, yeah, I spoke to Ewan McGregor last week or the week before. Irvin Welsh has just opened up his file of facts for me, as has Danny and Andrew, the producer. And, yeah, we've got the whole team together. And so I've been interviewing them the last year as well, and done a couple more interviews this week.
That's great, because didn't they fall out?
Yeah. They did, but I think quite famous, I suppose I can talk about it. They were going to do the beach together, and but it was I think the American finances wanted a bigger name, so Leonardo ended up getting the role, and Ewan sort of got bumped. I think they did three films together, didn't they? Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, and then A Life Less Ordinary, and then we're going to do the beach, and then what you just alluded to, they did. You bugger. But yeah, they did. Ewan absolutely loved that period. I mean, you remember that period, Tim. Oh, 96.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was living my life for you guys, watching on TV.
Yeah, Soccer M started in 96, yeah. And we were just like, it was just mayhem. It was so much fun. And that film was just there for us all, wasn't it? It was just backdrop to our lives, really.
You all know more than anybody. I think it was Morrissey, wasn't it? A couple of years prior, had supported Madness, and he came draped in a Union Jack, and he was outcry that he was a fascist. We probably now know that was probably true, but back then he come and because he had the Union Jack, and our Union Jack had been raped and pillaged by the right wing during that period when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, and there was Morrissey draped in it. It was only a few years later that Jerry Halliway had a Union Jack dress on.
Oh, interesting.
Liam Gallagher's now got it on. You know, everybody, and suddenly London was literally the epicenter of the world, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Damien Hirst. We had all the cinema, the music. I mean, the music, you couldn't escape it, could you?
Yeah. Was that Madstock? I seem to remember.
Madstock. Yes, it was, Tim. Yes.
Yeah, and I went there with my mates, and I remember being right at the back, and we were like, I don't know, we weren't dressed like rude boys then because, you know, it was years later, and I was right at the back, and we were going... I just remember going, we'll just watch a bit, shall we, and just have a little bit of a sing along, all of us at the back. And when they got into the don't watch that, watch this, yeah. And by the time we hit One Step Beyond, we just went on like a mission, and by the end of it we were at the front with all the skinheads, because it was like we'd never seen Madness play, and I remember talking to Suggs about that, and then I think it was on the what do you call it, earthquake scale,
because
everybody jumped up and down on One Step Beyond at one time. Apparently it registered an earthquake. That's funny.
Put that in our present climate, Tim, that many people together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it, now? Yeah, the idea of people being together.
I'd been to see a play called Performers, and it was about two East End gangsters interviewing for the film Performance.
Uh-huh.
And so I immediately contacted Irvin Welsh. I said, look, this is what I'm up to. He said, I'll come down to Edinburgh to see it. It was at the Edinburgh Festival. So I hopped on a plane and blagged myself down there and into Irvin's life. And I haven't really left it since. He's been, you know, the other week, you know, he was kind enough to get in touch with Iggy Pop. You know, he's just... it's just that when I go back to the word, keep saying the word journey, the bigger the heroes in my eyes, the kinder these people have been to me.
It's been right.
Really.
Because they don't have to try. They've got all the talent, don't they? They don't have to try. They're, they're, yeah. they're, They're confident.
I mean, I don't want you to give me any names, but you must see that with the amount of people you've met.
Always the really talented ones, the ones who are huge, they're always really genuinely comfortable in themselves. But that's because their art is for everybody to see. You know, their work is for everybody to see. So they don't have to be sort of assholes. It's when you're not sure of yourself, and I feel sorry for people like that. They're not sure of themselves, so they come across as slightly. You know, they come across as maybe aggressive or something, but it's generally because they're not sure of who they are. By the time they're sure of who they are, I think it's, you know, I think by then they're much more comfortable.
Yeah, I just I mean, I grew up with I shared a room with my brother, and so he was a couple of years older than me, and so consequently, my music and my tastes were, you know, following his view. Sadly, I lost him a few years ago. To brain tumor, but he's so every book's always dedicated to my brother Bobby, I think that's always helped, having that the extension into a better sort of artier time with music and films. You know, when you have an older sibling that perhaps doesn't know their sibling and they're influencing you.
That's the same with me. I had an older brother. Sadly, he's died cancer as well. But he was very much into the punk scene and stuff. And so people laugh at me because they always say, "What was the first single you bought?" And mine was Susie and the Banshees, Happy House. And they're like, "No way, that's so cool." And I'm like, I had an older brother. I wanted to impress him. So I went down and bought like the punk record at the time, which was Susie and the Banshees, which is interesting. Listen, we've come to the end of this. It's been fantastic talking to you. I'm going to ask you one question. I ask a lot of my guests. What's one piece of advice that has been invaluable to your life?
Probably two, really. Never take no for an answer. So three, I'm going to say, never take no for an answer. And that doesn't mean you've got to be rude and belligerent, but just keep following that path. Don't give up and be humble as well. When you're meeting all these great people, they don't want to be around a sycophant. They just want to be treated normal. And then they treat you normal. And the more you get from them when you're doing that has been huge for me. I've been around so many anchors in my time, and I just don't like them. Who wants to be around these people? And the long and short of it is just don't give up. If you've got a dream, I mean, I've barely finished school and now I am writing these books. So yeah, just don't give up, Tim.
I always think, I love that. And I always think when you meet someone who's really talented, like Robert De Niro, the best thing you can do is not pretend you don't like them, not be a sycophant, but just go, "Hey, I love your work. Right, now let's talk," you know? And it's just acknowledgement of how good they are at the beginning, and then go get on with it, because, you know, they know they're good and you know they're good. Let's just get it out in the open. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I met Bob to give him the Deer Hunter book last Christmas. He was doing a lot of press, and there was a lot of press there, and I see a lot of press at the different press junkets, and I'm not affiliated to any newspaper anyway, so I'm not on their sort of ground. And I remember the door opening and the whatever journalist was ushered out, Bob seen me, "Whoa, Jay, okay, let's go straight up to the suite." And I have to say, seeing all the other guys that perhaps, you know, you don't really give you the time of day at these press junkets or premieres. And there was Bob and I going up to his suite to look at the book. "Have you got the book?" "Yeah, I've got the books, Bob." "Brilliant." And we got into the hotel elevator and went up to his room. And yeah, it was wonderful just to have that love and attention from him. But also just because he was so enthusiastic.
It's always the way when someone who you really like actually knows your name. Ray Wilkins once saying to me, "Hi, Tim." And I was like, "Oh my God, Ray Wilkins just mentioned my name. I can't believe it." You know, he actually knew my name. And it's like, it just made me so excited. Jay, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much. And your book's absolutely amazing. It's called Raging Bull. Brilliant. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast today.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. And also as well, we've got a Cooker tap and they are absolutely cracking.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Seriously, man, everybody who comes round, they love it, and they've gone subsequently have gone and bought one. So yeah,
cheers. Thanks, Jay.
No worries, buddy.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.